Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody to the July 18th, 2016 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District. This afternoon, we're meeting both in a study session and a business session. We met this morning in executive session for 3 hours. And I might add, since the computer wasn't working when we adjourned, that at the end of that session, no votes were taken, no decisions were made. And so now we're ready to move forward with our session, our afternoon session. Before I do that, however, I'd just like to remind people that we ask everybody to silence their cell phones or turn them off. And we do welcome the public's input at these meetings. And we have a microphone up here at the table. If you wish to have input to any item on the agenda, we ask that you come up to the microphone and give us your name and address for the record and provide us your input or your testimony. Today, all five commissioners are here and all of the regular staff that we normally have, and we have a full house. That looks great. And so we'll start off with item two on our agenda, which is the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute, brought to us by Nicole Velcarez.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Hi, everyone. I'm Nicole Velcarez. I work in the IT Information Technology Department here at the district. And our safety minute today is about distracted walking. There's a front page article today on Pokemon Go where we have people walking all over town looking at their phones while they're walking, and that is distracted walking. Although that's been around for a long time, I myself used to walk to work while reading a book. So it's been going on for a while. I never fell flat on my face, but there were some close calls. So anytime you're walking and looking at your phone, checking a text message, or even just reading a paper as you're walking down the hallway, you are distracted. You're not looking where your feet are going, and you can get injured. And that can happen anywhere, hallways, walkways out at the hydros, sidewalks, parking lots, and even at home. As a matter of fact, 52% of the injuries from distracted walking is people falling over at home. So they're walking around the house with their cell phone, and they trip over that Lego construction that their kid left in the hall. So the key is, if you're walking, walk. Look where you're going. Watch where you're stepping. Don't be looking at your smartphone. It's just like distracted driving. If you're behind the wheel, you're driving. That's the point. So just real quick, going back to kindergarten, if you're walking and you come to the street, you're going to cross it. You look left, right, and left again to make sure no cars have come barreling down the street. And never expect a driver to be looking out for you. A lot of those drivers are looking at their phones. So always expect, never rely on a car to stop for you. And when you're out walking, just be aware of your surroundings. And that's our safety minute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good safety minute.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, we did go for a walk, my wife and I, yesterday in the park around 3 o'clock. And it was full. And fortunately, the bicyclists were doing a great job of negotiating the Pokemon players, and things seemed to work out pretty well. But it was like, wow, it got them off the couch.
At some point offline, I'd like somebody to explain the whole Pokemon thing to me.
Well, I asked and got an explanation yesterday, and afterwards it was like, uh-huh.
So, Commissioner, after the meeting, I brought my 14-year-old who does that. She can explain it to you.
That might be what I need, really. So, all right. Item three on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. At this time, if anybody wishes to request an addition on the agenda, or if commissioners wish to change any item, provide anything more, we can do it at this point. If there's no input, the agenda will be approved as presented. Item four is public hearing continued from the July 5, 2016 on high density load. And I am assuming I look at Eric Wahlquist to start us off.
Yes, Commissioner, thanks. I think the lion's share of the lifting today probably falls on me, but John Stoll and Lindsay are graciously at the table in case there are any questions that they can help me answer on the customer service and implementation side. So, commissioners, we are nearing the end of a long 18-month journey of public meetings, discussions, and rate design, and we are now at the point in time where staff is privileged to present to you a proposed resolution for your consideration, which would establish the new rate schedule and rate for the high-density loads that we have been talking about. This resolution grows out of the many, many public presentations and public hearings and meetings that we've been having as a district, and the board has been having in conversation throughout the last 18 months. The resolution was posted and available publicly, and I personally shared it with some of the concerned folks that have been in the meetings over the last 18 months with you and paying attention to this. So the resolution as presented does provide the factual background and the reasons for actions, as is typical of our standard resolution format. You will see that in this, beginning at the top of page 2 of the proposed resolution, there are some specific findings that the board would make as part of the adoption of the rate. Those continue until about the middle of the third page, followed by the actions section of the proposed resolution. So just briefly, the action section of the proposed resolution for your consideration is a finding and conclusion at section 1 that all of the requirements for the meetings and notices consistent with the board's rate-making resolutions have been met, or in this instance exceeded in terms of the contemplated number of those meetings. Section 2 adopts the rate and proposes an effective date of January 1, 2017. Section 3 describes the transition period that the board would establish consistent with discussions that we've had for existing HDL customers who can meet those criteria that are set out. This on-ramp transition period is designed specifically in response to the public meetings and the public comments that the board has received and has commented and expressed concern about for those existing HDL customers who were here prior to the moratorium and established and approved and had, at that time, invested substantial capital in either real property or infrastructure improvements. In the event that they meet those criteria, then Section 3F describes the on-ramp transition, and for the record, that contemplates a five-year on-ramp with a flat existing current rate for the first 3 years, then a 33% increase of the difference between their existing and the proposed HDL at the beginning of the fourth year, and another 33% increase for a total of 66 at the beginning of the fifth year, after which time they would be at the full HDL rate. It would establish a cap on the amount of load subject to the transition, limited to either their current actual or committed load. And then it would provide that in the event of any breach of that agreement, they would immediately move to the full HDL load. I do leave open, you'll see it, subsections 5 and 6, the ability for the district exercising discretion of the general manager to address any property or location-specific issues associated with the load being served or any other special conditions, as long as it's within these set of parameters. This is not a new way that we have established these kinds of forward-looking programs. We actually have done it a number of times in the past. The one that immediately jumps to mind is when we were back in 2001 talking about joint use agreements for the networks, fiber network system. We established a program very similar to this with bookends criteria and conditions for agreements moving forward. What it really does is allows for the efficient administration of the program without having to wait for additional board meetings and approval. Of course, if anything were to come outside of these predetermined conditions as a proposed alternative or exception, that would need to come back before the board for consideration and ultimate action. Section 4 is the confirmation by the board that the rate action is not a major action that would require or invoke the purview of the State Environmental Policy Act. And then, of course, at Section 5, this becomes the final resolution on this matter, and it supersedes other resolutions and discussions that are in conflict with it. I should have said, attached at Exhibit A as well is the actual rate, and then the Exhibit B is the final high-density load staff report, which in the event the resolution would pass, the board would adopt at Section 2 of the action section as its own record of decision on the matter. So with that, I am happy, and I know staff is happy, to answer any questions or concerns that you may have about any matter associated with this proposed action. If there are none, then I think it falls to you all to decide the next appropriate step, whether that is approval of the resolution today or some other action.
Hello, commissioners. Questions for staff? And I will be opening this up for public comment after you ask your questions.
Mr. Chairman, are you seeking perhaps a motion first that we can discuss, or do you want to have the discussion and then our proposed motion?
I think allowing public input first would be good. Yeah,
so my first was simply if you have any questions about what you've seen in the last months.
Well, since I'm hearing nothing from my fellow commissioners right now, I'll open up any comment or input from the public on the proposed action. Since I'm not seeing anyone coming forward to provide input, I would open to the commission. What is your desire for the disposition of the recommendation of staff?
Well, I was ready a little bit ago to make a motion, so I am still prepared to do that. Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept resolution number 4 as presented.
No, I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded that we adopt resolution 4 as presented. Is there any discussion on the motion?
I think having made the motion, I guess more than a discussion of the resolution is a statement of gratitude to staff. An 18-month process through a particular given topic that has been arduous in many, many ways. The willingness on the part of staff at all levels to reach out to the community, to hear those people who are most affected by this, to craft a document that meets those needs as well as the long-term needs of the other ratepayers in Chelan County. I know it's been long, but I think it's a process that has yielded a solution that gives us, as a commission and as a utility, the freedom to work across the board with all of our customers, whether you're a high-density customer or a residential customer. Embedded in this is the opportunity to meet high-density load needs as well as preserve the economic process that has allowed this utility to become what it is. So I guess without dragging it out any further, I know there's been a lot of individual and collective effort, and I just want to say thank you most sincerely for those efforts in bringing this forward. Appreciate it. It's a good product.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Any other discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I'd just like to say that members of the community have approached me to congratulate the PUD and staff for taking this extraordinarily long time, 18 months, in which to review with patience the topic of how a specific load, first of all, differentiates from other loads, making certain that it fit that classification, and then patiently deciding with the help of those individuals affected by a potential increase, and having open dialogue and communication. So this particular member of the community that I'm referring to was pleased to see the transparency, the public outreach, the involvement of the community in making these kinds of decisions, and not making them in a haste manner. So I want to congratulate staff for the tremendous amount of patience and energy and time that you've put into this to achieve a what I think is a very successful HDL rate classification. So successful that I might point out that members of the HDL community aren't even here today. So that tells you that they are not in conflict with this decision. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion of the motion?
For what it's worth, I just had to chuckle about our first meeting in Leavenworth. We almost broke loose in a fist fight to the placidness of the decision today. So if you know, even if it's not a good decision, all the edges got worn off. But you know, it was just interesting the transition. But again, I think it's the open process has brought about the has brought about the understanding. But that the first meeting was pretty interesting.
So before I call for the vote, I'm going to remind the staff and the public that I have recused myself from this subject, and so the whatever the vote ends up being, it'll be four people voting, not five, and. I was going to say, however, that it only seems like yesterday we were in Leavenworth.
Yeah.
18 months. Been that long. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. And I haven't commented on this at all, but I do recall that before I recused myself, and I think I was being interviewed by somebody at the Wenatchee World, I'm not sure. I suggested to them that what this commission was committed to in just about everything they do is looking for win-win scenarios, and I think you found one. I really do. So thank you for all you did.
John Lizzie, thanks. Commissioners, if I might, I should also say thanks to Charles, who's way back there in the back row, Charles Von Rees, who's put extraordinary time and effort into this process in the last 18 months.
Super. Thank you.
Many people have, but since he reports to me, I better make it. He might call in sick tomorrow.
Okay. Study session, item five.
Well, this is pretty amazing in terms of the timing, because I've been looking over my shoulder for the last 10 minutes, realizing we were going faster than I had anticipated, and we have a special guest that we were hoping we didn't show up, and when you know, he walked in the door just as you turned to me on that. So, Carl, would you come up and join us? Today we want to talk a little bit about the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. We really are very fortunate to have this fabulous asset just a couple of hours down the road in the form of a PNNL, and it's an opportunity for us to be able to think more about technology innovation. And are there ways that we can take advantage of technology to be able to benefit our customer owners? Carl is the director of the electric sector program. He'll describe this more in terms of what that means in just a moment. But what we really wanted to do today is just give you an overview of what PNNL is. We are moving towards putting in place an agreement with PNNL that essentially would allow us to do work as we find fit, where we see opportunities. We don't expect that as we start that the amounts that we would put in place would be high enough to require board approval. But should this work out, and I hope that it will, we may find ourselves at some point doing enough work that it would require board approval, and we just assume you're in at the ground floor as opposed to coming back and talking to you about it later. And besides that, I think this is a really unique opportunity for us to be able to, again, take advantage of a very valuable asset that happens to be in our neighborhood. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Carl. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. A little surprising to find some rain today. I think I need to bring an umbrella up here to Wenatchee in the summer. Appreciate the chance to come talk. I Have been at P&L since the week that Mount St. Helens blew. We'll see who remembers what year that was.
May 18th, 1980.
Excellent. And what I'd like to share is just briefly go through what is the laboratory. Just talk a little bit about Pacific Northwest National Lab. What is going on down at the lab? I'll share a little bit about our several decades of work in grid space. And I'll close with just a few of the thoughts about some of the discussion topics that are exciting to us. Based upon some of our recent visits, I think it was early June when we came up here and had our first conversation. So go through and then save a little time for some questions at the end. P&L is an Office of Science laboratory headed by or sponsored by the Department of Energy. It's been in the Tri-Cities now since 65 is when they started. It's about a little over 4,000 staff. As a national laboratory with a science background, our focus is on the fundamental science agenda from the Department of Energy. But we're unique in that it's only about 20% of our total business volume. We have three main categories of work. It's national security is the largest body of work that we do there. And it's right that people don't know much about what we do because that's just the nature of national security work. But the balance of the work we do is in environment and in energy efficiency, in grid, in nuclear power, and then fundamental science. So it's an asset of about just under $1 billion in the Tri-Cities. And we have a strong connection to putting that research and those new ideas to work. We have a strong history in terms of developing intellectual property and moving it off into the marketplace for the benefit of the nation and the taxpayers as well. Our main pillars for our mission are centered around earth sciences, energy sciences, and then national security. And a common theme that kind of runs through everything that we do is work on looking at adaptive, complex systems, whether it's a river system, whether it's the nation's power system, whether it's biologic systems, et cetera, and looking how do we understand them and control them, protect them and extract value from them. So this is sort of a common thread that weaves throughout all of our research at the laboratory. And I'm from the Energy and Environmental Directorate, where we work on electric infrastructure, we work on energy efficiency, which our region has a very strong tradition in for the last several decades, nuclear power, which was where we started our activities in the Tri-Cities, environmental health and remediation, and then lastly on clean fossil energy, looking at how to capture and sequester carbon and other results from consumption of fossil fuels. The laboratory operates at a time scale that's oftentimes a little different than the normal industry. We are expected by law, by Congress, to focus on issues of national consequence, oftentimes over the horizon, sort of beyond the current investment portfolio within the Department of Energy and other places. And we are expected to have impact in terms of new ideas and leading to important outcomes for the nation. The laboratory has four objectives that invests behind where we view ourselves as supporting the national agenda. One of those is on electric infrastructure. We've been operating in this space for several decades, and I'll share with you some of the results and legacy that we have and also some of our priorities going into the future. The others you see here are chemical conversions for carbon neutral fuels, radiation dynamics, which is linked to a healthy nuclear industry going into the future, and then a very deep look at terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems. So our vision from the electricity power perspective is to exert leadership for the nation so that we can move towards an inherently resilient and robust power system of the future that delivers both substantially improved performance for reliability and economic efficiency, but also looks at some of the new possible control approaches and paradigms for how we might run the system. And lastly, has strong transparency and engagement with consumers, giving them the services and value that they look for out of the power system. And I think you can sort of divide our work up into two categories. One, we work on improving today's practices for the power system. But then we're moving into an era where we're able to see the system and control it like never before. And so the question is, are there new paradigms or new opportunities for operating the system that the operators of 20 years ago might not recognize? So again, that near-term, long-term, we're working on improving today's practices, but also looking for new possibilities and new paradigms that would be good for the nation going forward. Just a quick preview of the last several decades. We got into this business when we started to work with Bonneville Power. As they began to work with Southern California, dealing with the system oscillations between the Northwest and the Southwest during the large power flow activities. Back then, it was called time synchronous data. Today, they call them phasor measurement units. But long story short, it's a very high-resolution monitoring system that lets you look at the system health over long distances. And this was our first entry into this space. We brought in advanced mathematics and signal processing to help support the use of this new monitoring system. It was first used for diagnostics in the 96 outage, which hit here in the Northwest. It grew then to where we actually lead now for DOE, the North American Synchrophasor Initiative. And the value to the American people is as follows. In 2003, when they lost the Northeast, if they had had phasor measurement units then, they would have had an hour and 40 minutes warning that Cleveland was starting to pull away from the rest of the system. Hmm. At the time, the operators couldn't see it. At the time, we thought, working with the leaders from industry, if we had 300 network devices around North American system, we would be able to have the situational awareness we need to avoid those kind of potholes. We just recently lit up 2,000 network PMUs, 300, not 300, but 2,000 across the nation. So we have unbelievably enhanced ability to see the system. So now we're working with the tools to help operators extract value from that, not only to avoid those potholes, but also to squeeze more value out of the assets and other things, because we can see it like never before. Now, how do we take advantage of that visibility?
Places here I might interject to places where this is relevant for Chelan PUD. So we are currently looking at PMU data to see if there's a way that we can better understand how our generators operate and see if we might be able to capture more value out of our generators. So just more data gives you better opportunity to understand how the system is actually operating as opposed to how we think it would be operating and what we use in our planning tools.
So just a quick question. A pothole, I'm assuming, is a blackout.
Blackout or, yeah.
I love your terminology. I just want you to know that.
Okay, good. Just a couple other items on the time frame. In the late 90s, we started looking at how could we engage demand to help maintain reliability of the system. Might it be faster, cheaper, perhaps lower emissions than the traditional backup generation support? So we did some fundamental work. Some of the utilities said we don't need any demand response at the time. But today, PJM and others have very large ancillary services and demand response markets growing and providing value. So we're usually about 5 to 10 years out on some of these activities, but then we nurture them going forward. Lastly, we led the Northwest Smart Grid demo, which was about 5 years ago here as part of the AARA activities. We worked with the largest one on the East Coast as well with American Electric Power. And for a lot of the investment grants where utilities upgraded their distribution automation and metering functions, we put in place the cybersecurity design requirements and then worked with the utilities to help figure out how to meet those requirements and then did the debrief to look for lessons learned. And that was one of the biggest impacts we saw in the whole activity was a lot of the small and mid-sized utilities for the first time got exposed to good practice with cyber activities and learned a lot from that exercise. And that and PNNL was central to that across the nation. Our overall effort is really divided in these main areas. There's the traditional bread and butter of transmission reliability. The third one down is working on the distribution system, which is a little more your focus. But here we're looking at bringing enhanced value and advanced reliability or enhanced reliability to consumers. In between is called grid analytics. And this goes back to our connection to the fundamental science side of DOE. We're bringing high performance computing, parallel computing, advanced mathematical algorithms, advanced visual analytics that's flow from cognitive science, helping operators figure out how to better interpret the data streams that are coming at them to really transform the tools we use to watch and control the system. Then stationary energy storage, this is grid scale energy storage of all types, batteries and other types, which we view as a compelling degree of freedom for the grid of the future if we can get the price points down. It's still too expensive today, but if we can get those price points down, that gives us a lot of degrees of freedom for operating the system in the future. And then lastly, unfortunately, we have a lot of challenges in terms of cybersecurity. And so this has been a part of what we've worked on since the late 90s. And this is a fundamental part of everything that we do. And we lead some of the largest programs in the country, and I'll share those with you as well. Just to give you a feel for how we go from scientific results to actually bring them out to bear with the commercial community. This is just a quick snapshot of some of the things we delivered last year. I mentioned some of these high-speed monitoring systems and analytics. We took Bonneville State Estimator from about four-second convergence for their state estimator down to about half a second, and we're working now with them after their kind of proof of principle, working with their vendors to help install this into their control room. With General Electric, the main power flow solver that they use with many of their customers around the country, we doubled the speed of that tool, and that's important as a lot of the planning studies and all that get more complex and take longer to run. This helps, you know, provide better throughput for the utilities. And we work with PJM Market out east and New England ISO to bring new forecasting tools that can reduce the error in their forecast by up to 30% or 40%, which means really real value in terms of their operating budgets. Worked with CAISO on helping them deal with the increase in uncertainty with renewables, bringing stochastic tools to their control room, basically, and to their forecasting capabilities. In cyber, we lead the largest program with utilities, where we share information between the non-classified utility world and the classified intelligence community to get that information to the right place at the right time with the right protections, and monitor some of the key assets. I think by the end of this year, we will be involved in the analytics and supporting 75% of the conduit miles in terms of utilities in the United States. And we'll talking with you all about looking for ways to get smaller entities such as Chelan involved in that activity as well. And then lastly, the Secretary of Energy has launched a new integrated grid modernization initiative based upon the priorities and urgencies that they've seen through the quadrennial energy review, a multi-agency review a year ago. And I and another laboratory person have co-lead this activity for the department. It brings together 13 national laboratories working together to support this new major national initiative on behalf of the Secretary. So that's just a snapshot of where we get out of the Tri-Cities and actually engage with industry around the country to try to deliver some of this value. I've already talked about many of these things. I'll just say a few things in terms of each of the main pieces of business. In transmission, we currently lead for DOE, the North American Synchrophaser Initiative. That's working with over 80 utilities around the country, including many here in the Northwest, trying to extend the value they're extracting from those new monitoring systems. And we're also developed for DOE, a new tool to look at cascading outage risk at scales unheard of in terms of prior analytics, such that we can look at the impacts of either cyber attack or physical attack or storm or earthquake issues, and give operators more confidence that they understand where the real risks are and how to best minimize the number of potholes that they encounter. I never used that twice in one talk. In the distribution system, the thing I'll highlight here is we're working not only on demand response, but we're also looking at the architectures of the future grid. 10 years ago, we had very little interdependence between natural gas pipelines and power generation. In the East Coast, they just about lost it a year and a half ago because they had such a transition from coal to natural gas. And also communication networks are much more fundamental to how we operate the power systems, both locally as well as across the interconnection. So these are examples where the architecture of how we run the system is changing. And we're working with industry to help figure out what is that new reference architecture? What are the interdependencies between various systems that have to be accounted for when you're purchasing new equipment, designing new lines, et cetera? And then lastly, we've done a good bit of work on plug-in hybrid-electric vehicles, developing analytics suites for DOE, such that the commissioners around the various states can use those to figure out what are the impacts of plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, how can utilities take advantage of them to not only serve local policy needs, but also perhaps even enhance reliability, you know, capture those vehicles to help them with reliability management. We did lead this Northwest Smart Grid demonstration. It completed about a year ago, June. It was 11 utilities across 5 states, a strong focus on what's the local business case. Each 11 utilities did what they thought made sense for them locally. It might have been renewables, it might have been distribution automation, it might have been demand response. But above them, we framed an additional set of value propositions to help with wind ramping, to help with transmission congestion and other things, and use signaling called transactive control that would capture these various responsive assets across these 5 different states. and validate how much value might they bring to a regional agenda as well as still serving their local agenda. That was a major leadership opportunity for the laboratory, and I think we got a lot of good lessons learned for the region. Mm-hmm. We're extending that now, working with some campuses at the University of Washington and WSU, to go very deep into those campuses and capture some of the responsive assets there as well as the P&L, and integrate that so that it can be a value at, to the regional level in terms of ink and deck and balancing and other resources as well. So this is kind of the cutting edge of our research and new architectures and new control approaches. We have a long history in working with the Corps and the Bureau and Bonneville as well on hydropower research. We directly support the DOE hydropower program. We're excited about the prospects of perhaps having Chelan be a partner on some of our bids and programs in support of DOE. We work on fish passage. We work on turbine design, grid integration issues, and then visualization tools to help operators enhance their operation of the hydro system. Just a few of the areas that we've worked in the past, both dealing with tagging fish, understanding fish behaviors in the power pool so that you can get better optimization in terms of the power pool applications, bringing in material science to help support turbine design, et cetera, a broad range of activities, mostly for Bureau of Reclamation, the Corps of Engineers, and then a good bit with Bonneville. We have about 80 scientists and engineers down there working in these areas. We also have a marine research lab out at SQIM. It's the only place in the laboratory where people can go salmon fishing over their lunch hour. You guys might come lunch here on your dams. I'm a little jealous of that. But we're also looking at developing some new laboratory facilities down at Richland, and in discussions with Steve, you know, those new activities might actually have some linkage with your agenda here at Chelan County PUD as well. And so there might be some opportunities for some partnerships there downstream.
Let me just take a second to draw a little more clarity around that, that we've proposed or have included as a public power benefit item, Hydro Energy Research Institute, and looking at that. So we're trying to figure out, is there a way for us to connect up with P&L and Carl's group in particular on, they've got a core group of people who are working in this area. We've got an interest in pursuing it. Is there a way that we can work together on that?
In the cyberspace, I'll just be very brief. The new information sharing program I referenced earlier, it was based upon technology that P&L has used for over 20 years to monitor the business networks of the entire DOE federal infrastructure across the U.S. We took some of the sensors and concepts out of that and worked with five large utilities around the country to look at to see how it applied to their business networks as well. The trial went well, and now we've turned it over to NERC. NERC and the EISAC are leading that activity, and we support in terms of the analytics, linking the high side analytics to the utility analytics. The utilities own the data. They choose what data they send in, and then P&L is involved in the analysis. We do that out of Richland. We have hardened facilities down at Richland where we do that work. But they lean heavily upon the 80-plus power engineers that we have on our staff so that they really understand what might be the real impacts of some of these issues that they see so that they can provide good analytic support to the utility industry. Grid-scale storage, we're trying to drive the price points down on materials research, but we're also working hard on the analytics, trying to figure out where in the system will storage add value, how can storage access multiple value streams, how do you trade off or compete storage effectively with other things like combined cycle gas turbines or efficiency or demand response or other things? It's a very complex business case to figure out. So we're helping DOE put in place better analytics and better evaluation tools to help people make better local decisions in terms of if and where and how storage adds value to their local activities. We just constructed a new building based upon our overheads there this year. Our grid program is the largest of the grid programs at the, across the national laboratories. We do about $50 million a year of research in grid space. And in this facility, we have the largest amount of live operational data of any non-operating entity in the U.S. It's heavily protected, and we work with it both in support of the industries around the country. But we've also been awarded some awards from ARPA-E and others to begin creating data repositories that are anonymized and such that they can be available to the innovation community, to the vendors and others, to, again, accelerate the rate at which we can innovate and support the industry in these very exciting times. So this facility and the people there is, I think, a really real asset, and we think it might have some value not to SLAM PUD in terms of operator training and looking at next-generation tools and visualizations, et cetera. We will be working with vendors like GE and others to define the control room of the future for the bulk system operations. But I think there's a lot of potential benefit to the hydro operation side as well. Secretary Moniz, I mentioned earlier, has launched a major new integrated initiative at DOE. It's targeted at around $350 million a year, 60% of which is the existing program, and then there's some new money slated for that. Congress gave us good bipartisan support this year in the first year. We launched it this past year, and it's focused on an integrated strategy, kind of breaking down some of the internal firewalls in DOE, looking at both technology as well as new frameworks for evaluation and other things to help the nation as they go through the grid modernization agenda. I mentioned we had 13 national laboratories. That has been quite a challenge to get them all lined up and head in the right direction. But you'll see here the six general areas we're working: devices, sensing and measurement, operations control, planning, security and resilience. So let me just close. I've shared with you kind of what goes on at the national laboratory. What are we doing in our grid space? And I'll just close with a few of our thoughts. We had almost a full day here. Steve and Kirk and many others here in the room were good hosts. They wore us out. And we talked about a number of things. Some of them that jumped out at me, Steve, were as follows. There seemed to be good interest in terms of cybersecurity and how might smaller and mid-sized utilities engage in some of the cybersecurity activities and leverage some of the assets there. Some discussion around the hydropower. You guys have some opportunities coming up, and are there ways that we can link some of our materials research, environmentally friendly lubricants activities, and some of the data analytics to help with the condition monitoring? Where might those add some value into your agenda? You guys are looking at some smart grid activities, and we have a large base of existing relationships with utilities who are well down this pipe or pathway, and we have access to a lot of the lessons learned from the investment grants and all over the last 5 years. So I think the first step would be to help you guys tap into those lessons learned and be able to talk to us about the utilities to see kind of what did they learn and what might be of value here to SLAM PUD. And then this issue of regional hydropower issues. We're very actively involved with a lot of the federal entities here in the region. We'd love to get a stronger connection with some of the mid-sea folks such as yourselves. The Secretary is looking at something called Mission Innovation, which is trying to identify some clean energy regional projects. I think there's going to be a meeting in Seattle in August. That's an area of some potential linkage with you all. And then Steve mentioned some of the other things where we might have facilities there that could be virtually connected through the computer networks or other things, or some staff exchanges to help support some of what you're doing here. And it would be of high value to us to have Chelan support us and advise us on some of our DOE programs. It's of high value, and we have utilities who bring in real-world experience, so they have operating units, so they really understand where the rubber meets the road and kind of help DOE set priorities on where they're trying to invest. And that's another area of potential benefit for us. There may be some other things, Steve, from your perspective.
Well, I'd add a couple things. I think one of the areas, just to pick up on this point about hydropower, I think we've expressed to you before an interest in trying to figure out whether there's a way to be able to develop and use sensor technology to help us better understand what's going on inside the turbines without actually having to pull the unit out and all of the associated cost and time associated with an outage related there. So we're trying to figure out, is there something we can do there, and can PNNL help us with that? So that's one. I want to reinforce this point about Secretary Moniz has been, I think, is very well received on Capitol Hill and has been effective through the development of what's called the Quadrennial Energy Review to begin to get a focus on grid modernization efforts, and has been getting some funding for DOE in these areas. That means there may be opportunities for partnership, and the fact of the matter is we have this great asset in Carl and PNNL that sits down the road that is extremely well connected to what's going on back there and can help us figure out if they understand what's going on inside the Beltway and know a little bit about what we're doing. I think they can hopefully be a mediator that can help us to better understand where there may be some opportunities there to that can get us towards some of the objectives that we want to accomplish. And then finally, it's just the fact of the matter is, if you have an entity like this that has all of this capability, it just seems to make sense if they're so close by to try to figure out there must be some things that we can work together on, because we have a lot of challenges and a lot of problems, and we certainly see the capability that they have and think, well, there need to be some, or there should be some ways that we can work together to be able to create some real value, certainly for our customer owners. So with that, I throw it open to any questions that you may have.
Commissioners, any questions?
Are you fully funded by the Department of Energy?
We probably get 60% of our funding from the Department of Energy. That pie chart up front showed the exact numbers, but a good amount of our funding comes from the Department of Defense and some other three-letter agencies. Our national security business is about half of our business. And science is about 20%. But about 20% of our total business comes from others, 15 to 20%. So that would be utilities, industry folks like General Electric and Alstom Grid. So it's roughly 80-20 government, non-government, and defense is roughly half of the total.
And it says proudly operated by Battelle. So is Battelle a private group that...
They're a contractor.
They're a contractor. Okay.
They're a not-for-profit entity based out of Columbus, Ohio. They've operated this facility in Richland since 1965. Went through another review, and I think they're going to be around for another 5 years. But that is the operating contract for the Pacific Northwest. The laboratory is a DOE asset operated by a contractor.
You've got 4,400 staff. How many research scientists, approximate?
About 60%. Of that group, about 60% of those have PhDs, and most of the rest have master's degrees.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's what you call a brain trust.
Yeah, the old adage is that there's more PhDs in Richland than there is Cambridge.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, but there is some truth in that. You don't want to go by a square mile. I guess a question I have, and it's just one that's looming, and it's it affects the, you know, the revenue stream, which is one of the reasons why we get to hang around. As we look at states in on the West Coast continue to develop their renewable portfolios, and you have the EMI taking place, one of the things that it reduces hydro to is becoming the battery for those other states and their, you know, political leanings that take us in a different direction. Yet at the same time, we continue to invest public dollars in those states and in the Northwest to build resources that aren't needed. And I guess I don't know if you guys get into the economic analysis of that whole process, but it would seem like perhaps if there could be a clear demonstration in terms of the actual cost and cost benefit to that, would it be a chance to catch the eye of the Department of Energy and others who would have perhaps some influence over balancing that out to where green energy is fine, no problem with that whole issue, but how do you remedy taking your lowest cost energy and reducing it to the format of a battery, while higher cost energy continues to be subsidized all through taxpayers, ratepayers? And so I guess it's an economic question. I don't know if you guys get into that or.
We do. We have a number of energy economists who work hand-in-hand with power engineers who work on the production cost models, which is a planning tool that we actually use to support the Northwest Power Pool as they looked at the energy imbalance market issues. It's very complex, a lot of complex ownership relationships on some of these large generators. And we actually supported the industry in terms of getting good data in and providing the tools for them to do the that they felt was compelling. And the Secretary Moniz is very committed and and recognizes the strong regional differences and energy challenges around the country. He is pushing us to advance the quality of the tools and the data and the analytics that are available so that the right entities in the regions can use them to make more informed decisions. Now, you know the complex layer cake. You have the states, you have the balancing areas, you have the interconnection, you have the reliability councils, you have the Western Governors Association. There are lots of players in that space. Our primary role is we have technical assets to provide the data and the analytics to support those activities, and we do work with a number of those.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Fascinating presentation from my perspective. I could just see all kinds of possibilities going forward. Where they are, he'll have to figure out.
Well, on behalf of my lab director, if anyone's in the Tri-Cities would like to come by to visit, I'd be happy to set up a visit, or if you're down talking to Energy Northwest or anybody, you know, just let us know. We'd be happy to take people through as a group or individuals if you're in the neighborhood.
That'd be fascinating.
Thank you. Fascinating. Phil Long was an employee of yours? Phil Long?
Yeah, I remember Phil.
Do you remember Phil? Yeah, he's a friend and a neighbor of mine. And he's retired now and trying to start a Lakeland Research Institute, which would be fantastic.
Is he up in Chelan?
He is. Yeah. He grew up around here. Regards. I will. Thank you.
So, Anne, since you broached names, Mike Scott?
Oh, know him well. Met him the first day of work in 1980.
That's my son-in-law's father. So.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll have to get a hold of him, though. He's gotten kind of scarce out there.
He's having fun with his grandkids.
He failed retirement for the first 10 years. He's figuring it out.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
Okay. Next up, we're going to bring up group talk about customer information system.
Well, good afternoon, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. With me, I have Carrie Wendell, the Manager of Customer Accounting. We're here to give you an update on where we stand with this project. No action is required, just a good opportunity to answer any questions you might have and kind of report on progress. But it does set the stage for an upcoming request for proposal that the board will authorize staff to move forward on that will come sometime over the next 6 to 8 weeks. So with that, I'll turn it over to Carrie.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Today's update is going to include a background of the CIS, a little bit about the project team and what we have done so far, our areas that we're focusing on, and we'll talk about the schedule and our next steps. So back in December, we were here and introduced the need to upgrade. And our current PeopleSoft CIS was implemented in 2004. And our vendor technical support ended in 2009. So the current platform does not support the future strategies. And basically, the CIS is at the end of life. And it's time for us to upgrade to continue to meet our customer expectations. We were also here in March, and a resolution was approved to hire a consultant to guide us through this process. So this is a list of our project team. This team consists of a very hardworking cross-functional team. This team's commitment has kept this project on track and on schedule. They've definitely made this job their top priority along with their regular jobs. And for me, I'm very fortunate and appreciative that our leadership has allowed these people to be dedicated to this project. I'd also like to mention there are 4 veterans in our group that were involved with the original 2004 implementation. I don't think Jill's here, but Jill Stevens, Ken Smith, and John and I were on the project back in 2004. And I believe that there's a lot of value and lessons learned from this group to help us out with this project. So from this slide here, you can see CIS is a core system with customer information and data that supports all areas of the district. The system is reliable and these areas depend on it. Each department utilizes different pieces of the data. And as I mentioned before in our last presentation, CIS is complex and critical to district operations. It is critical with over 3,000 tables. There are over 100 processes that make up our nightly billing. There are over 700 general ledger codes, and over 500 reports are ran and queries to ensure that our system is running smoothly. It is very critical as it serves as the billing and payment processing for electric, water, wastewater, fiber, loans, secondary sales, slice contracts, and there are others. And there's over 100 rates. And it also holds our meter inventory and meter reads for all this from all the systems. So CIS is critical to these other district operations, including conservation. Tracks all of the I-937 programs and CIS bills for the fiber service providers. The Parks Department uses CIS to track the parks passes, and communication utilizes the emails for outages and all of our customer communications. So as you can see from this slide, CIS is definitely critical to district operations.
I'd like to add to this slide, you know, you saw a pretty large project team who was looking at the requirements. This really brings it home to me and where it shows where it feeds into all these other systems and how many folks rely on it. There's a lot of horror stories around customer information systems that go sideways. So it's really critical that the people who use this system, you know, understand what their requirements are. So when we evaluate these, we have those perspectives in mind. So again, back to Carrie's comment, I appreciate folks taking the time to support this effort.
So we've been working with AAC Utility Partners since April, and we've completed this list of deliverables with them. AAC has a clear understanding of the various offerings, and they understand the functionality that's being offered by the vendors in today's market. The team has spent a considerable amount of time and multiple meetings going over the system requirements. Each requirement was ranked based on functionality and looking into the future, how we can improve our business processes and add benefit and value to our customers. AAC has walked us through this process as they have a proven model that does a comprehensive review of CIS functionality that systems today have to offer. The outcome of this process gives us a high level of confidence in the requirements that we feel that we need in a new CIS system. So from the review of the requirements and the needs assessment, it is essential that we get what we have now with the core CIS functions and the batch scheduler. These are the primary areas of focus for us. The batch scheduler, we have currently about 80 jobs that we run daily, weekly, or monthly, and that's why we feel that the batch scheduler should be included with the core CIS functions. So the other important areas that we are evaluating in the RFP include the customer self-service, the mobile work management, the mobile app, and the meter data management system. So we see value in these areas that relate to customer benefits and efficiency improvements around the district. AAC has helped us understand what these functions include, and we're closely analyzing all of these options as we go through the evaluation process.
This will be pretty critical when we get to the process of evaluating the responses that we have, and this will be down the road. And then when we bring vendors in to demonstrate that, then we really have to take a critical eye at those options that Kerry has mentioned around. We certainly want to get that core system, but we want to understand the value in those other options and as we move forward.
So our schedule and next steps, we are in the development, RFP development is in progress. We spent many hours of work has gone into this by the team. And so we're anticipating a really good RFP that will bring a competitive market with multiple vendors and solutions for the district. The staffing plan and risk register are scheduled to be done at the end of the month. And we plan to be back at the end of August or 1st of September to present the resolution to advertise the RFP. So at this point, I feel that we have a great project going. We have a knowledgeable consultant, and we have an awesome project team. So we're on track, and I think that we're going to make this project successful because we've got all of those going in our favor.
Question.
Not so much as a question, but more as a, you know, as a statement. I think there's recognition on the commission's part that each one of these, the CIS, the AMI, and the metadata, are three separate but can be related systems, and each one will have an individual cost component to it and another cost component that will allow the systems to be integrated as needed. And so I know that coming kind of out of the shock of the PeopleSoft adoption is, I think this commission is fully prepared for what the cost may be. We just want the cost as is, as needed, when pertinent. But I think the thing that is most important, at least for me, is that the customer information system, not only continue that great relationship that we have with our customers, but enhance it. And when we all attend state PUD meetings, we're very aware of other utilities who have not done as thorough work as they needed to do before implementation. And so implementation occurs and the holes in the system become apparent and significant, and the relationships disintegrate between the customers who own the utility and the people in the commission that work there and are responsible for it. So I guess what I'm saying is let's make sure we take our time and shoot straight and get a great system that can do what it is we want it to do and to integrate down the road as we would like it to. But I think furthermore is please allow enough time and budget capacity to fully beta test the system. As thoroughly as you people feel we need to do over whatever length of time that it is, so that when we roll it out, I don't expect it to be seamless, but I would love for it to be as close to seamless as we could get. So I guess what I'm saying is don't feel pressure in terms of a hasty decision or a hasty implementation. Take the time to select a great system. Take the time to get it beta ready. And let's roll this thing out and do it with the same quality as we have done almost everything else that we do. I think if we take a look at the exercise we just went through for 18 months on the high density loads, we need to follow a similar kind of thing in order to roll out our systems. That is where our greatest integration with our customers is. And just please take your time, and we're going to be there to support you financially in that process of doing so.
Thank you. Appreciate that feedback.
Notice I didn't say unlimited.
That being said, what is your expected timeline for implementation, and how long will this system last?
Well, you know, actually, just from the schedule that we've put in place, I mean, Commissioner Bowles, very sage advice. We want to do it right, not push it. Carrie's mentioned we do have some experience on this that we are going to leverage and learn from and continue on. But it is a new world. We did buy a very robust, what they would call a tier one customer information system back in 2002. It was approximately 2 years to get that system implemented. We went through a lot of business change. We went through the whole bi-monthly to monthly billing. A lot of processes changed. From that standpoint, we've been through some of that and we have some of those lessons learned. So, kind of rule of thumb, you typically look at about a 2-year implementation. And again, but that testing, the quality control, the quality assurance is a big part of moving forward. And if you're not ready, you make sure you're ready. And we did a little bit of that last time. We certainly want to do that. How long do they last?
How long's a piece of string?
Yeah, well, we've made this system last, and it's lasted very, it's served our customers very well. Yeah. I think 10 years is considered, 10 to 15 years is probably on the high end of the scale. We've probably all seen stories where utilities will swap out these systems in 2 to 3 to 4 years, and I just scratch my head when I see that. But, our goal is to find a good, durable system that will serve our customers and provide that optionality for added value. We see it.
Not to be facetious at all, but you're talking to a farmer who thinks, a 35-year-old tractor is still a pretty good tractor. But I do understand we live in the world of technology, and I buy a new laptop probably about every 6 years. So, okay, other questions? Thank you for the update.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, commissioners, I told all of you that I thought our balanced scorecard was entirely up to date until I really looked at it closely and discovered that there is one item that needs probably more intensive review than the others, and we have all agreed to report exceptions only. So I will... I'll be talking with General Counsel tomorrow about annual review.
Oh, thanks. I thought it looked up to date to me. No, we do need to schedule that.
We do need to schedule that. But the other four white items on the board have not been scheduled yet. So we're perfectly up to date on everything. I don't know that we need to go through all of them. If you want to, we can. Okay, I didn't hear any rapid response, so we're now down to our business session, and we have a consent agenda. Commissioners, what is your desire?
Mr. President, I move that we adopt the consent agenda. Approve it.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Manager items.
Got quite a few. Actually, we want to give you an update, first of all, on the insurance program. You may recall we brought that to you in advance of the signature, and Ron Gibbs will give you an update on how that turned out.
Ron Gibbs, Insurance and Claims Manager, just here to close the loop with the results of this year's insurance program renewal. Back on June 20th, you approved a motion to renew the district's insurance policies for an amount not to exceed $2,245,000. As expected, we finalized those premiums at $2,239,000, 4.5% reduction. And as a reminder, both internal and external factors resulted in the reduced premiums. Externally, there haven't been any major natural disasters or any major significant claims patterns. The insurance companies therefore maintained healthy margins of both profit and their reserves, and so they that allowed the marketplace to remain competitive for us. And then internally, the district's financial strength and also the strategic objective to invest in generation assets, as well as our formal asset management program. Those all made the district attractive to insurance companies, and that also further resulted in reduced premiums.
Super.
That's all I had.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Nope. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Eric to do a quick update on the Entiat Park agreement.
Oh, thanks, Steve. Commissioners, so last year you'll recall perhaps that we came to you with a 1-year lease and operating agreement for the Entiat Park following its opening and dedication ceremony. The anticipation was that we would use that 1 year to evaluate both on the city's behalf and on our behalf exactly what we would be able to expect in terms of the operating expenses and perhaps the revenues that would come from the activities in the park that carry a charge. And then we were thinking we would be back this year with a formal lease and operating agreement that would more closely align with the license for Rocky Reach. So last year with the fires, the park was used as a firefighting staging area, and what that did was upset the evaluation that was going on with the revenues, because everyone believes that probably what we saw in revenues last year is not going to be typical given that it was otherwise occupied. And then there were some additional expenses caused by that use as well. So instead of being back to report that we have a lease and operating agreement more in line with the full license term of Rocky Reach, the city and the district staff decided it would be appropriate to try another year to try to align those expenses and revenues. So we've executed, pursuant to the delegated authority that this board granted to Steve, a 1-year lease and operating agreement for 2000. It's actually started in June and will go till next June. And then we hope to be back next year to report the execution of a lease and operating agreement that aligns with the Rocky Reach license. Happy to answer any questions about that. Did want to give you an update because we were at the expiration of the first 1 year and executing another.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Question?
Yeah, I have a question. Eric, Jim Brennan, the landscape, Jim Brennan, they did the design, didn't they? And Associates.
I'm sorry, I don't recall.
Deep Roots. Deep Roots, did they?
And Jim Brennan.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, there was an agreement that I think that they would maintain or maintain the plants, all the plantings for 1 year. Is that, where's that going?
So there was and is always a warranty associated with those. I know in this instance there was a little bit of discussion because we had the critters that were chewing the trees and they were sticking upside down out there. I don't know exactly what the status is or if there's been any issues with it since then. I'm happy to look into that, though, Commissioner, and report back to you.
I've got lots of real positive comments about that park.
I fully expect that if we had issues, I would know about it. So I assume that there aren't any, but I'm careful to want to check before I just represent that.
Are we going to talk anything else about parks? Well, I'll just make my comment. I could have made it during question items. I took my grandson to the science camp at Rocky Reach last week, and that the grounds they're always beautiful, and I know they win awards this year. They are just phenomenal, just beautiful. If you haven't seen them, they have a new, they've done the flag again, which they always do, which is beautiful, and then the sun with the rays on the little plateau area, and then they've added, I think it's new, the river with flowers. It looks like the river, mm-hmm. And then they have the fish, the salmon, metal salmon cut out, you know, along the, it's just magnificent. And I can't remember names. I just wanted to congratulate the folks and the supervisor. I think there was one gentleman who's taken this on as a project from day one, and he's just done a beautiful job. But I don't remember his name. I apologize.
Todd Shales?
Who is it?
Todd Shales.
Is he still there, or did he retire?
No, he's still
there. Well, my congratulations and thank you to him and his group. Oh, it's just beautiful.
It was interesting in the article related to the flag just to hear his voice tone come through in the writing. And known Todd for a long time, and he is a really good person, and really cares about what he does. I won't say that it was his fourth grade education that helped him be what he is, but anyway, that's
it. Okay. Additional man to your item.
Yeah, I've got a few more. So I want to invite Kirk Hudson up. Recall that the four big units, we've had challenges with the staters. Three of them, we've had stator problems. One, we hadn't until last week. So
just an update on the large units at Rocky Reach. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. And we've had, if you recall, some of the show and tell with the stator strands and the strand-to-strand shorts we've had on the large units. We've had problems first with Unit 11, and then we had shorts on 8 and then 10. And Unit 9 was the only one we haven't experienced any issues with until last Thursday night about 11 o'clock p.m. The smoke detection system worked as designed. We got a smoke alarm from the unit. The operators intervened and shut it down immediately. At that point, we did an inspection the following day and noticed the same similar signs of insulation from the stator burned in the same locations on the end turns where the high stress areas are. So that unit is down. Just to give you an update on where we're at, progress, C8 is down with the long-term repairs currently in place. We're waiting head covers at this point for that one. C10 is being rewound as we speak with the generator. We expect to have C10 back up and running in October. And C5 is actually a planned maintenance outage that we started overhauling that unit. So we've got four units down as we speak. The good news with this one is we have some options we can look at. A lot of the work we did, knowing this was a high probability risk, seeing what we saw in the other three units, if you recall, we awarded a contract for the materials to rewind each of these units. We awarded that contract last October with an accelerated delivery schedule for the materials pre-delivery on all four units. So one set is already here. Another set of winding bars is expected to be here in the next 3 weeks, and then another one will come in October. So we'll have materials to rewind at least three units. Now, the challenge is gonna be when to do it, given all the other work we have going on. So we have in the middle of these large repairs, that's gonna be what we're gonna be looking at over the next 2 weeks, is what's the right timing. It's possible you could repair C9. We didn't have good luck with C10 trying the repair. That's why we went into the rewind. But that is another option we can look at. It is potentially a repair. So over the next 3 weeks, we'll be looking at all the options. Where does it fit best in the schedule? But we do have some options available to us because we have materials coming that we didn't have on some of the other units. So with that, I think just open it up to questions. And
Where does that put us at our generating capacity now?
We're right there.
We don't have any flexibility.
Yeah. Right. We're using every unit we have, and there'll be times, at this point, the flows are starting to drop off. And just even last Friday, there was times where we were able to pass all the water through the remaining units. And then there were times where the flows pick up a little bit with the release of water, and we have to spill additional water. So I would expect that to be the case over the next 3 weeks till we get back to the point where we'll use the remaining units and we can pass all the water through the units. So we're right on that edge of the flows coming down. So it would have been great to finish all of July without any issues. We're right on that.
And how long till you have the first big unit back online?
So October.
Yeah,
now just a reminder, that one's just a rewound stator. The large turbine repair first unit will be C8, and that'll be next June.
Okay.
But we should get, right now 11 is operating, and we should get 10 back in October.
Okay.
So I just want to say, Kirk, you don't ever show any discouragement or it's been a unbelievable year for you of challenges. So thank you.
3 years.
Thank you. Yeah.
But who's counting?
No, you're not counting, right?
It will end eventually someday.
Well, this
You'll
one,
get caught up.
This one we've practiced for. So this one was a little bit different. Thanks for your encouragement there. This
you
one
bet.
Was one that we had practiced for, and we've done a lot of analysis around. We've made some decisions to expedite some materials because of the risk. So,
Kirk, one, that 3 years coincides with Steve's arrival. Is
it
that,
does.
Who was going to point that out? Coincidental.
Nice you to bring that up.
I was wondering what you meant when you said it'll end soon.
Thank you.
I want to invite Suzanne Hartman up to talk a little bit about our outreach in the Latino community.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Suzanne Hartman, Manager of Communications. You remember at our last commission meeting, Commissioner Bergen brought up the notion of how are we doing, are we reaching out maybe to the orchardists and the warehouses and so forth, and we were not. Not with our Hispanic outreach. And so he and I talked a little bit after that commission meeting and kind of came up with a little strategy. And I have reached out now to 10 warehouses and Crunch Pack, plus Crunch Pack. And 8 of those 10 have been quite open and quite willing to help us. And they just received their materials about mid last week, so about a week after, 10 days after the commission meeting. And they've started delivering them and having posters up in their locations. And one informed me that most of their crew is gone now until apples. So we kind of missed that opportunity. They had cherries and kind of missed that. But quite pleased with the response from the warehouses. And we are seeing a little blip of increase in applications. Not, I don't think yet from this, right. But from our other efforts, because it's a little soon to tell, but we're monitoring it closely. So.
Well, thanks, Suzanne.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Suzanne, I just want to compliment you on your email yesterday that as this hasn't been much of a summer yet, and just the optimistic spin that at least the weeds pull easier with the rain.
Yeah. I've enjoyed being in Seattle again.
Final item is just we had a follow-up from the last meeting to get in contact with Mission Vista, and just want to let you know that contact has occurred. We didn't find a particular opportunity right now to pursue. The low-income piece didn't attract them, but they wanted to continue contact about other opportunities along the way, so we're planning to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. And I think that's it for today.
All right. Commission items. And
better look at my calendar. I did not attend the was not able to attend the Washington POD Association meetings, so I can't speak to that. I actually have had my daughter and two of my grandsons with me for the last 2 weeks, so things are kind of a blur. Let me look on my calendar. Sorry, I'm not prepared for this.
Yep. I am ready. If
you, okay, go for it.
You give everybody and a little bit of time. We did have the state association meetings at Kalam County PUD, which also provided an opportunity for them to take us through their new facilities in that county. And I thought the meetings went well and were informative. I think people did a good job. Looking forward to the retiree luncheon this week and the opportunity to spend some time with Greg Carrington on reviewing the real-time agreement. Next week, a meeting with Steve and with Eric. August 1st meetings, and then also just an awareness that I have the opportunity to serve on the Awards and Recognition Committee for WAPUTA's annual conference. And so we'll be starting some of that work shortly. That's pretty much it.
Okay. Carnan.
Well, okay. I had kind of a light week. I had planned to go to state meetings in Port Angeles.
Yep.
Yeah, and wasn't able to because of a medical emergency. And plan on going to the retiree luncheon on Thursday. Followed up next week with Energy Northwest on the 27th, 28th. And a meeting with Eric is coming up. And I too had a, during that time that I was laid up a little bit, I did review the real-time agreement with Greg as well. So anyway, that's my report.
Okay. Bouncing around, Gary.
Well, I'm going to sound like an echo of everything that's pretty much been said so far. I did have an opportunity to meet with Eric one-on-one. Also, a phone conversation with Greg Carrington regarding some real-time agreements. I did attend the state meeting for the Washington Public Power Association over in Port Angeles. There's no doubt about it. That's a long way to go. And then as I look forward, this coming Thursday on the 21st will be the retiree luncheon, which I plan to attend as well. And on the 25th, 1 week from today, we'll be having a tri-commission work group meeting as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll jump in here, Randy. So I plan on attending the retiree luncheon as well. I wouldn't miss it. I love that. That's always a great event. And the only thing I'll add is that I mentioned that I took my grandson to the science camp, and it's terrific. I've taken him before. Bob Bauer's fantastic. They started day one with the tour of the fish hatchery, and it was short. And, you know, it sounds like taking, you know, first to fourth graders to a tour of the fish hatchery could be long and difficult. But, no, it was great. They did a great job. And then followed up with 2 days of magnetism and electricity and kind of magnetism and gravity and electricity 101, and they just do a terrific job. So huge thank you to Bob Bauer and to Debbie Gallagher and to the group out there. It's really, really great. It's a free science camp, of course, and I'm glad that people take advantage of it. It's terrific. Super. That's all I have. Thanks.
All right. Well, looking back, I also attended the association meetings and won't elaborate any further than my fellow commissioners have on that. But prior to that, I went back to Washington, D.C. on behalf of our utility for the APPA policymakers summer fly-in, and had our meetings in preparation for going on the Hill, and went on the Hill on last Tuesday. And I just have to share one small story. I mean, the meetings were all very good, and I could tell that our issues are being heard readily, and I think Steve has been back there also, but we were in Kathy McMorris Rogers' office with a young staffer whose name escapes me at the moment. We were talking about our hydro provision, which has been championed by and credit for early action, which has been championed somewhat by McMorris, Congresswoman McMorris. And I said, well, now, you know our manager, Steve Wright. And the young staffer looked at me, and he sort of shook his head. He said, I may have heard of him. I said, well, do you work with Suzanne Grissel? And he said, oh, yeah, I know Suzanne well. So, and so, you know, he was, you know, obviously Suzanne's been getting a lot of work done on our behalf, and you'll get to know him anyway, Steve. but I thought that was rather fun that they're both in their, you know, well, they're young, you know, younger than us. Looking forward, I've got a couple of meetings tomorrow down here, and I'm going to be going to the retiree luncheon. We do not need to name that as a meeting, correct?
Not if no business is conducted and you're just there to enjoy yourselves.
Well, we'll be there to enjoy ourselves. And I think that's pretty much my report. Anything else? Delegation of action items.
Before I start, I might add one. So for that retiree luncheon, I was originally scheduled to be there. I probably will be there for just a few minutes, but I've got an opportunity. The Seattle Chamber of Commerce is doing a tour over in this area. They wanted to get to know the east side a little bit, and I have an opportunity to speak to them about the value of hydropower that came up at the exact same time. So I'll be meeting with them. In terms of action items, first of all, follow-up from last week, both of which we talked about. The first one was the Latino outreach. You heard from Suzanne about that. And the second one was the Mission Vista call. So you've heard about that as well.
Okay.
Got two from this meeting, both having to do with Entiet Park. The first is the lease agreement and the status of the warranty items. So we'll get back to you about that. And then I just heard a compliment for the landscape activities out of Rocky Reach, and we'll make sure that gets passed along.
Yeah. Super.
And just on a stroll through the park yesterday, the one here in Wenatchee, they're in incredible shape. They're just great. There's been a lot of nice additions and some, it just looked great. It was just a very prideful opportunity to walk through. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, and the two Osprey are back.
Ah.
You know, okay. Was that Wilson and Carol? Two Osprey are back. So.
Is there any additional public comment?
Yes. Could you, I ask you to come up to the mic. This is the time. Come up to the mic and introduce yourself. Give us your name and address. Right.
I'm Sally Van Dusen. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Sally Van Dusen from the White River. And I'm going to pass this out. I only made 6 copies. I wasn't sure how many people would be here today. So I don't know if you want to copy and pass or share.
We can share.
Yeah.
We'll share here.
Anyway, yeah, White River, Lake Wenatchee, far end of the spectrum. Jules of Chatham County, and you, I know I remember you. We were here, there was more of a tribe of us about 10 years ago at the beginning of the fiber optic movement, and we all did our acts of compliance and submitted and, you know, hoorah, and 4 years we're going to, you know, do the build outs to the more rural areas and, so that was over 10 years ago. We all came down. And I even spoke with Ann afterwards to ensure that we would not fall through the cracks. And in the meanwhile, I think things shifted. There was a problem with the program not being quite as profitable as you had originally hoped or planned or designed. So that guy got fired. Somebody got rehired. Everything got shuffled, and so anyway, they did have one, you know, this is all secondhand smoke, but this is my understanding because I've been following this, that there was a new budget and a new plan for build out, and then whoever was in the this is the fiber optic division, whatever happened there, that gentleman was let go. They brought in somebody new who tripled the estimate our road. And so anyway, a couple of years ago, I resumed speed with Bob Shane in at the fiber optic department. You did a survey. We all complied. We built it out. It said, yes, we want build out. We want build out. And you, and it said to 90% of the county. So I called Mr. Shane and I said, hey, are we 90%? And he gave me the stock answer. Said, well, you got to understand, every year, first January, we go over our budget, we look at our numbers, and this is what happens. And I'm like, okay, well, are there any other criteria? You know, is this just zero sum? Like, the only way for you to win is that we lose? And anyway, so nothing happened. And so called again, had a discussion, wrote the letter, it's on the record now, and at the end of the phone conversation, more stock answers. Well, if you contacted LocalTel, which I had, because they've been putting up their signs, 1-800-888-888-888, you just call, we'll just do it. So we were LocalTel, and then, I don't know, at the very end of the road is Tall Timber Ranch. They get over 100,000 people a year attending their camp. And they went ahead with the association there and raised a bunch of money and had Localtel come in. They put in their own private tower at another tower at Little Wenatchee. And problem being that the rest of us residents on the road don't benefit from it. So they've got satellite, we don't. And so then, anyway, on and on and on. So, and then I talked to Bob Shane again. And he tells me, well, yeah, this is going to be like, we have $25 million and we're testing in Manson. You know, and so anyway, I called him. I said, well, listen, I got 60 acres. You can test up White River, too. You know, I volunteer my land. And if you want to add some super battery cell thing. And anyway, bottom line, nothing. And so I'm just here today saying, hey, it's over 10 years later. We're underserved. We have a phone line that was put in, but the amount of users on that phone line has exceeded its original size, so they've spliced. So right now I'm on dial-up, and so we're getting half the dial-up and paying full price for our phone line with Frontier. And also, I discussed with Bob Shane the fact that over 40 years ago, you put a underground power up our road, which we adore, being underground, with the understanding that that was meant to last 25 years. And here we are 40 years later, more residents, you know, diminishing conductivity on that line. There's been splices and repairs. But anyway, it might be time for a little maintenance and upgrade on that line, and I don't see why you couldn't have maybe the maintenance and repair department working with fiber optic to piggyback your projects, to maybe just throw a little fiber optic cable up there at the same time to save money. So the other good news is that, you know, tall timber's off the map, so you've saved yourself 2.5 miles of installation for fiber optic, because they don't need it, but we do. I could go ahead and put some giant, you know, pay thousands of dollars and do a giant tower on my property, but it wouldn't help my neighbors. So anyway, I'm just wondering why we are underserved by the PUD. As you can tell, I'm a little frustrated. The other problem we have that I want to throw into this, if you're taking notes, is our phone line is supposed to have a battery. And when the power goes out, the battery is supposed to serve our phone line. So we can call PUD and report power outages. Well, I don't know. Between you and Frontier, nobody knows about the battery. And bottom line, when the power goes out, we have no phone. So that is another huge problem. And I'm just going to check my notes. Okay, so to continue, Mike McComas raised $20,000 to extend the fiber optic line where it was stopped at Lake Wenatchee, which is about a mile before the Little Wenatchee Road, and volunteered to do the work for free to install the fiber optic cable up to the beginning of the White River Road. And you denied that, saying that there was a conflict of interest there. So it's not like we have not been working on solutions for a while, is my point. And also, I guess after that huge storm, 3 years ago, the ice storm, you paid $1.5 million to restore the fiber optic cable to the south shore of Lake Wenatchee, which was 6 people. So those are just the numbers. But, you know, we don't expect something for nothing. And I represent all the neighbors and residents on the White River Road. So I'm here representing them and being the voice. Because I could have 40 people in here. We have a real crowd going. But I think I can speak pretty. And, you know, we don't expect something for nothing, but I think the dialogue really needs to change and the criteria, because public doesn't mean some. And we're not poor. You know, we're residents. But we pay our bills. You know, my neighbors are multi-generational up there. So I don't understand really where the problem is, where the decision lacks. And I'm coming to the commission because I have heard that basically when the fiber optic department has their meetings and White River is mentioned, they laugh. You know, like, yeah, it ain't gonna happen. And that makes me a little upset when I'm given stock answers and told to hold. I just don't think that's right. I don't think it's fair. And, you know, Mr. Wright, respectfully, we get your letters and tell us how profitable the company is. And just go to www.qd.org.com.this.that. And we can't do any of that. I can't even barely sign on to my website because there is so much data coming onto the websites now that my half a phone line can't download it. So it's a problem, and it's a real problem. And it's not, you know, when this started 12 years ago, it was people were like, oh, gee, I couldn't live up there without a cell phone. Well, nowadays, you can't even run your appliances if you're not synced with your internet and all of that. And so it's getting serious. We're reaching critical mass here. You know, for all my contact with fiber optic division, they never contact me back and give me an update. I've heard nothing. And so I'm, you know, we're all frustrated. But just, you know, okay, so just picture your life. If you couldn't go to Amazon, if you had no Facebook, no iTunes, no YouTube, you can't even get your parts for your appliances or your warranties unless you WW go online. There's no, you can't book your travel. You can't watch videos. You have no, I don't even know the name of it, Rebum or whatever that thing is you need to get Netflix and all that. Hulu. No,
Hulu.
It's rude. You have to have that box. Roku. I don't have Roku, thank you. So anyway, I think if any of you who are sitting here today had to live where we live and deal with what we deal with, you would find it unacceptable. And that's so I hope this is going to bear some fruit and maybe get a conversation started and maybe some action. And like I said, we're reasonable people. We don't expect something for nothing. But I think you're actually putting us in harm's way by ignoring us. And there's people that are a little more upset than me. So any questions?
Just a comment. I don't know if you came in and after I made the announcement, but when we don't take notes, we do have a recording of this. Everything you said is recorded, just so you know. Yeah, so we have captured what you've said, and you've spoken at a really very good time because our director of fiber is in the room, and I'm sure he's been making mental notes, and we'll go back and we'll get back to you in short order.
I have a friend who works for Fiber Optic in Seattle. My understanding is what we're talking is a little, maybe 1 inch trench in the asphalt to lay a line up the road. It's you know, it's a very strange situation.
Well, I'm sure Mike will be getting back with you in short order.
I just got a question for you. Yeah. How many customers up there were you talking about that would sign on to this?
You know, all the way up the road. I'm sorry, we're not a huge thing, and if you don't go to Tall Timber, you're eliminating quite a chunk. So I would say there's maybe 20, you know, between the beginning. It's a 4-mile run. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for safety, security, communication, all of that, I think it's necessary. There, terrain and all, it's in my letter.
Okay.
So, thank no, I'm
okay.
sorry.
Thank
not
you.
A huge
thank
profit.
You.
No, I was just curious how many people were interested in the fiber and would sign up. And if you had that number, I'd just be curious to know what it is. And
no,
then
I think you lost a lot of business by waiting. I think you would have had some really loyal people who really would have used the services and needed it by not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioners, Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. I wanted to let you know that I am very aware of Ms. Van Dusen's situation up the White River. That is one of the tough areas in the county, and it is an area that we constantly look at and monitor. We did go above and beyond the call of duty in assisting Localtel in establishing a tower on our Natapoc site so that they could serve the White River. I'm also aware that Localtel, the form of Dimitri Mandelis, has made every attempt to get wireless into that area. I think one of the things that I would like to put out now is the fact that it's really not just as simple as running a piece of fiber up the road. There's many other considerations with that. It is a very, very difficult construction area, and it is also large distance, low density, which compounds it. We are looking at that, as you know, on an annual basis to say, what can we build out for the following year? What do we need to have budget for? And we're consistently following the direction that the board gave us, which is to look at it from a least average cost base in each area and use the budget that you're giving us under the public power benefit to achieve a build out to 85 to 90% of the county. Beyond that, we also do have a wireless proof of concept going at Manson. We're currently collecting data off of it. And the purpose behind that wireless proof of concept is so that we can get the information we need to do total life cycle cost studies and determine if we can put out a reasonable wireless solution that will provide reasonable service to these remote areas of the county. And if so, what kind of a life cycle cost will it have, and will it compare to fiber? So there's many things that we are doing. We are responding to every letter, every call that we get. I was very much aware of Ms. Van Dusen's letter and very much aware of the response that went back on it. We also have continued to work with Localtel to facilitate their deployment of the wireless system that they're using. In addition to the things that we're doing locally, I also can tell you that Frontier has received a considerable amount of money under the Connect America Fund II, and that area is one that is tabbed under Connect America Fund II, and that would provide something better than standard DSL. It would provide up to 10 megabits in that area. The thing I don't know is the schedule that Frontier will keep to in building out to these areas. So at the end of the day, we know that we have some areas in the county that are very difficult, very expensive to serve. We continually look at those areas and say, do we have an alternative that we can apply to that area to provide reasonable service? The final answer to that is probably several years away. We don't know what's going to change in technology in the near future or the midterm future. We constantly will continue to look for solutions to these difficult areas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. So, Mike, is the biggest barrier, the largest barrier to serving White River, is it the fact that it's the distance and the low number of customers, so therefore the cost is considerably higher?
I don't know the exact location because I don't have it in my head. The nearest fiber to that is many miles away. So it's not just the distance up the White River Road. It's also how do we get the right type of fiber, the distribution fiber, from where it's at now up into that remote area. So yes, it comes down to very large distances, and that combined with the very low density is what drives up the per premises pass cost.
How far up the White River are you? 4.5 miles.
Yep.
Mike, I know some time back we discontinued the battery backup system. I don't think they have that system up there, but who would be responsible for
that? They don't. Since they don't have fiber, there is nothing that we have a battery.
Yeah, we don't. Okay.
Right. From a technical perspective, if she's having problems with the telephone line going down because of a battery, that would indicate that Frontier has a battery issue at their DSL node.
Oh, they have a battery. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to remember what we did with the battery backup, and with our fiber customers, we did discontinue that and then refer them to Localtel if they wanted to have their own system. Is that how that worked?
That is correct. Okay. We removed the batteries from the power supply that provides power to the ONTs. Mm-hmm. And the reason we did is because it was only a small subset of the total solution. It only kept the ONT alive, and it actually gave a customer false confidence, because if they didn't have a separate uninterruptible power system to maintain their telephone system, their computer, et cetera, then they still had internet, but they had no way to use it.
Yeah.
So that was the decision that we made in 2 years ago, and we have continued with that battery removal program on a steady pace since then. Mm-hmm. In the case of Frontier, in order to provide service out into these remote areas, they either use a very small self-contained remote central office, or they use a different technology to provide both telephone and data. And so those remote central offices or nodes have to have battery systems, and if they're not maintained, they don't last as long as they should last.
Yeah, I just wanted to make it clear that we don't provide battery backup for any of our fiber customers, and that
we do not.
Yeah.
The local retail service providers have several solutions they can offer to customers that provide more of a total backup system to fit their individual needs.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Mike? Thank you, Mike, a lot. Any other public comment? Do we, in fact, have need for an executive session?
We do, sure.
We do, sure.
Okay. If there are no other matters to come before the commission, we will adjourn into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become party, and legal risks as authorized by the RCWs. This is Chelan PUD Commission, July 18th, 2016. We've been in executive session. No votes were taken. No decisions were made in executive session. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.